Welcome to the Mac Observer's Background Mode Podcast. This is your host, John Martellaro, and this week, my guest is Ken Case, the CEO of the Omni Group. Ken, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you very much for being on the show. This is going to be fun.
Yeah,
I've been a follower of you for a long time. I know we did an interview with you back at WWDC back years ago, 2010 maybe.
And sounds about right.
Jeff Gamet is a big fan of your products, big user, swears by them. Especially Omni Outliner for some reason. That's his favorite toy.
I guess now that that I haven't been able to maintain OmniWebs regularly. He used to be a big OmniWeb user as well back.
He still
over
is.
A decade ago.
You know what? Those thumbnails, the sidebar with the thumbnails is a brilliant way of keeping track of your tabs. It's a better tab metaphor than squeezing everything into the tabs. Yeah. I used OmniWeb myself for quite a while. Are you still maintaining it, or is it sort of RevLocked?
I am using it and maintaining it enough to keep it working for me, but I haven't. WebKit has changed a lot between WebKit 1 and WebKit 2, and so it's not as stable yet in the newer version, and I'm not quite ready to ship this version out to the public as it stands.
Well, I got to tell you, I was a big fan of it for a while. I sort of fell into Firefox, though. Yeah, it's been my web browser of choice for years now. I just like Firefox. I like the idea that they're independent. It's not made by any big company. Of course, yours is in the same boat, too. I think I'll have to go back and try OmniWeb, see what it's like. So I wanted to ask you, how did you get started? I know you got involved with Next in the early days. And we talked a little bit a while ago about the Omni game, and I wanted to find out if you ever actually had met Steve Jobs. Let's kind of reminisce for a while.
Sure. Well, I guess one question is, how far back should we go?
What got you involved in Next Software?
Let's see. I was working at the University of Washington. This was in the 80s, late 80s, and I was working for the computer center there and as a systems programmer. And they got this lab of Next machines in there. I'd been following Next for a while, of course, because I was a Unix geek, and Next was a pretty exciting new Unix platform to come along and program very differently. But at that time, I thought the most important thing for me was to write code that, you know, if I was going to spend a bunch of time writing an application, I wanted as many people as possible to be able to use it. So I was programming for the least common denominator of Unix, right? So I was either, you know, just programming basic text stuff, or I was using X Windows. And Next obviously wasn't, you know, you could program it that way, but it wouldn't really feel like a Next app. So, I didn't pay close attention to it until we got this lab. You know, Next seeded the university with, or maybe they gave us a great deal or something, with 10 machines to be used for students and then 2 machines that got to be used in the back offices. And when they set this up in the computer center, they started setting it up as they had set up their PCs and Macintoshes, where students were expected to bring in whatever documents they wanted on their own media, which in the case of Next was a floptical drive that cost, or, you know, an optical drive cartridge that cost $150 or something, which was kind of a big burden for a student. And then you would be using it on this thing, and it was really slow. As soon as you logged out, the whole machine would reset so that it would be ready for the next student, which meant you'd lose any preferences you'd set up and everything else. I asked my boss, hey, can I set these things up to be real Unix machines? He said, sure, if you want. So I sat down, read through, you know, learned Objective-C. This was in 89, and started, you know, reading through the AppKit documentation and so on, and fell in love with it and decided I didn't want to program it any other way from then on, because that was going to make me enough more productive that it was worth losing the audience.
So you had that early development system on the Next machines, right?
Yeah, all of those Next machines had a full development environment along with them. Which
that was the grandfather of Xcode.
The IBM mainframes, Unix hard drives, so that people would have, you know, a decent amount of hard disk space available instead of without having to bring any media in and could have accounts. The first big project that really then started working on, I guess, was, I don't know, there's so many different ways to look at that. The first consulting project that we worked on together was for Lighthouse Design, and that was the big ISV for the Next platform at that time. And they made software like Diagram and Concurrence, and so we helped them build Diagram 2 and design the file format for that, which we thought ought to be a text file format, so it's easy to, you know, for customers to get at their own data. And
so if you were writing software for Next, Steve Jobs loved you, right?
Well, yeah.
Did you ever meet him?
I did meet Steve, yes. At one point he asked, well, you know, why don't you guys just, you know, throw in with us, come work down here. You know, that was, he's a very personable person when he wants to be, when he wants to wanted to turn on the charm. So that was a pretty tempting proposition, but really enjoyed doing what we were doing. So obviously that was after we founded the Omni Group. Before then, I did work for Next briefly, but just as an independent contractor out of their local sales office up here mm-hmm. in the Seattle area. So they had some big, you know, Next went through several phases. And I guess we could be talking for 2 hours if I take too long on this. But they went through a desktop publishing phase, and then they went through a mission critical custom apps phase. And I skipped a couple other phases. And mission critical custom apps is sort of what stuck. And so they
were trying to get traction somewhere. They thought it was going to be in the universities, but it ended up being with the government and the security services, right?
And businesses in general, sort of business automation at that point. Mm-hmm. So that contract that they hired us to help them out on was the William Morris Talent Agency. You know, so in the in show business, you know, figuring out they wanted an app that would help them manage all of their, they called them talents. So, you know, different people if they wanted to cast onto a show or decide who they were going to invite to direct a project or so on and so forth. So it was just basically a big database. And at that time, they were working on their database kit, DB kit. And shortly, you know, with our feedback on that project and from other people, they ended up inviting us to be on an advisory board where they ended up creating the Enterprise Objects Framework, EOF, which became the foundation of their Web Objects Framework a few years later when the web started becoming big.
Right. What was the appeal of the Next machine? I know Andrew Stone was telling me about how they built a really good database program that Steve loved.
Yeah, so I think...
What was the PC not doing right and Next was doing cool?
Part of what Next was doing that was really great about this was you were building things in an object-oriented way, which, you know, is it sounds like a very obsolete buzzword now. It was kind of a big buzzword back then.
It was a big thing.
But creating these views with a great object hierarchy the way that you interacted with AppKit, it was very well designed. The way, you know, DBKit was their first pass where where things were modeled sort of oddly, like every object was a record, but you couldn't really subclass the record. EOF was their second generation, you know, redesign of that, where they let you create your own model objects and those got stored in the database. So they sort of mapped directly to the database, which has its good and bad points, as we all learned in those years in the 90s, that SQL is a very powerful model for mapping things. And some of those relationships, when you try to shoehorn them into an object model, aren't necessarily as efficient, let's say.
So let's jump forward a little bit. So tell us about the forming of Omni. You're one of the co-founders?
Yes.
Yeah, and the vision for the products that you have now.
Right. So on that project, we had several people from the University of Washington, were necessarily working at the University of Washington, but that we knew each other from the computer center there. So it was myself and Timothy Wood and William Shipley. And the three of us worked together on that, as well as our friends Moe's and my brother Len. And so the five of us, I guess, were working for Nexus as independent contractors. But three of us were working full time, and we ended up, when Nexus decided their part of that project was done and they were ready to hand it off to somebody else, we formed a company that we called the Omni Group, which is named after a game that we had been working on sort of in our spare time independently of all of this.
What was your first Omni app?
The first Omni app, well, I guess that depends. The first Omni app that actually shipped to customers, as opposed to being something that we wrote internally and didn't ship, I think actually was OmniWeb. Is that really true? We also, you know, we wrote some other things like Omni Image back in the early 90s. So Next it was a great multimedia device, but it didn't have support for formats that were becoming popular on other platforms like JPEG and GIF. And so if you wanted to read one of those files, if you wanted to view an image on the Next, basically it had to be a TIFF file or it had to be an EPS file. And so we wrote a little image filter that we called Omni Image Filter, which would let, if you installed that on your Next, you could read JPEG and Bing and Targa and some hundreds of things that were available out there. Mostly because we didn't write all of the logic of those things. We just wrote the integration logic. So it was based on some open source Unix code that then we wrapped, and we gave it away for free. OmniWeb, though, was probably the first app. Well, it was the first app that we ever sold to people on any platform.
On the Mac?
On the Next.
Okay.
So back in 94, I think, is when we started selling it.
But it has made the leap to the Mac.
Yes. Yeah. So let's see if we quickly jump through this history. We end up with Next sort of turning into just enterprise software for the Windows platform, because their own platform didn't really succeed on the Next, and or even Next Step for Intel and other processors. So we started looking at other things, but then in 97, you know, Apple announced that they're, or late 96, the end of 96, Apple announces that they're buying Next, and we all went, yay, we get to program in Objective-C and apt-get after all, just on a different hardware platform.
That was the salvation for a lot of developers who were in the Next circle. When Steve came back to Apple and brought all that object-oriented development environment into Apple, and all of those staff members who were sort of insinuated into the Apple technology, like Bertrand Soleil and other people, Bud Trimble, it kind of like recast Apple as a company.
Yeah, there were a lot of changes in those years. And it was, of course, little did we know how long it was really going to take to make Next be the Next platform work as well on as a mobile platform, right? That Apple had laptop devices and Next never tried to really run on laptops. You could run it on an Intel laptop if you wanted, but you had to keep it plugged in all the time or your network would, you know, your machine would hang. So either keep it plugged into the network all the time or have it not be on the network at all. It had no idea of, okay, how do I switch from my IP address?
Right. It all started off of what was called, as I recall, the yellow box, right? Wasn't that the first implementation on OS, Mac OS?
Well, they had a notion of a yellow box and a blue box. So Rhapsody, as it was going to be, was going to run Unix underneath, but then it would run all of the OS 9 software in what they called the blue box, and all of the Next software in what they called the yellow box. And the yellow box would also run on Windows. That was the promise back then. And so if you were a developer and you wanted to write software that would run both on Mac and on Windows, you would write it for yellow box. That was an interesting time.
Yeah, it was. There were a lot of developers who were resistant to what became Cocoa, but now it's Cocoa all the time, everywhere. Took a while.
It did take a while. It took, I think, OS X and the Aqua interface to start even convincing users that this was a worthwhile move. I think before then, users weren't really sure what the advantage was, other than, you know, they wanted preemptive multitasking. A lot of developers wanted, you know, saw the advantage of that as well, but having to rewrite all your code, that is not something anybody wants to do, or throw away all the apps you're already using.
It's something the industry just had to get through. Well, I would like to take a quick break here.
Sure.
When we come back, I want to talk to you about the current days with the Amnay Group, what's going on with you now, and the development situation in 2016 with Amnay Group.
Sounds great.
Folks, we're going to take a quick break. We will be right back.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage, where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
And we're back. Thanks, Kelly. So, Ken, I want to ask you about, as I do with many companies involved in Apple development, about the current state of the art and the situation with Omni as an Apple developer. One of the things I want to start with is you've been very successful in building very high quality products that command a slightly higher price. I've talked to so many developers who have complained to me that the App Store has sort of diminished the value of software, and that customers are loath to spend more than 99 cents for anything. But you've bucked that trend.
Yeah, I certainly have. I guess I've never really felt like that was a trend that applied to our customers, let's put it that way, right? That, sure, there is an audience out there of people who want to buy apps for 99 cents. And if you're trying to reach that audience and you're trying to sell them $199 project, diagramming tool or something, they're really not going to be interested at all. There's no way that you're going to break through that market. But if you are instead looking at people who are working through their days and are looking for ways to save themselves some time and therefore some money, if you can save them some time by giving them a good solution to their problem, then they're happy to pay $299. Well, in the case of our project management software, $299.
How did you cater to or nurture that customer base? Was it word of mouth? Was it being early on the App Store? How did that work? Because you've been so successful.
Well, it certainly helps to be early on the App Store. I mean, being there, you know, we were on the App Store on day one, both on the iPhone and on the Mac when that came out, and then on the iPad when that came out as well. So being there on launch day means that you get featured, or you at least have a better shot at being featured. Obviously, we can't guarantee being featured. But I think the biggest thing that we tried to do was just build software, you know, listen to our customers, find out what their needs were, and then try to meet those needs so that we got good reviews from people, you know, so that they loved using our software and then they were happy to tell other people about it, leave good ratings, and that word of mouth, and as you say, has been the primary way of getting the word out.
Were there other channels, like particular avenues of advertising, or certain journals or other websites or Twitter, or were there certain channels where you sort of were able to reach out to the class of users who needed these severely good productivity apps?
We have advertised, and we do advertise. You know, we advertise in productivity-oriented broadcasts most often, I guess, as an advertisement target. And that reaches a class of people who are, you know, looking to figure out how can they make themselves be more efficient and save some time. And mm-hmm. That's a good way to reach that audience.
Now, in the time since we talked to you last, there was a WWDC interview that I mentioned before. You've grown quite a bit. Apple's development environment and WWDC events have changed quite a bit, too. Tell me your thoughts about that.
Sure. Well, back then, I think you said we were about 45 people when we last chatted, and now we're at just over 60. And a lot of that growth of our staff, I guess, was just because we needed more people to work on what we were doing as we spread out across Apple's platforms. And so I think really our growth has been largely driven by Apple's growth as the iPhone and iPad become more successful, as the Mac has become more successful, then that justifies larger investment on our part. But when it comes to WWDC and bringing their people there, back in 2010, we were able to send as many people as we wanted to WWDC, as I recall. And of course, that was things started exploding. Attendance there had started exploding even before then because of the iPhone. But most of the people were not yet in the know about what Apple's conferences were, as opposed to people who had been going to WWDC
right. since 2010, you had 18 people there.
Yeah, so we knew to sign up early, and we were there, signed up within hours of it being posted, and and that was good enough back then. Then pretty soon it became, well, you had to sign up within minutes if you wanted to get a seat at all. And then it became seconds, right?
Yes, seconds. Like 89 seconds.
And we managed to get a few people in the door, but some people several of us had trouble just reloading, and we couldn't even get the website to respond in time, but we did get a few people in the 89-second run. So I was kind of happy when they switched to the lottery system from that point of view. It's more fair, less rushed. People in other time zones are better represented.
Do you feel that your company has suffered a little bit by not being able to send so many people, or have you been able to connect with Apple on other wavelengths?
If the conference were run today exactly as it had been back then, I think we would have suffered. But it's changed quite a bit now, right? Now they stream all of the sessions, and you can get see them usually the same day, I think, this last year, but at least by the next day. And so it's really not as big a deal to not be there in terms of the content that Apple's presenting. And that's a great change that they've done.
Does your development staff watch every one of those videos that Apple puts on the site?
Eventually, I would say. Yeah. There are probably five or six tracks going on at once, so they're not all going to happen at once. But we have, our team back here, we have a theater here at Omni, a theater room set up, and we, during the week, we'll just sit there and play WWDC videos from the previous day on it. And so when I was at WWDC in person last year, but when I got back here the next week, most people were all caught up with all of the same information. I didn't have to really share anything about that. So what I brought back from there was the things that I learned from conversations with other developers and other people.
How do you feel about the sort of the rubbing shoulders aspect of WWDC? If you can't be there and you have to watch the videos remotely, there isn't that sense of social occasion. But there are some side events that people have ginned up that allow people to still strike deals and socialize and maintain ties.
Yeah, well, I decided that even if I couldn't get a ticket to WWDC, I would plan to just go down there and be there during that week. So the last few years, I signed up for the lottery. I don't necessarily hear back, but I go ahead and make my travel arrangements anyway. And I figure that if I don't get a ticket, I can just go chat with people in person.
You guys are in Seattle, right?
Yes. So, yeah, from Seattle to San Francisco is not that far.
Yeah. So
mostly the hotel bills that make that cost.
Right. So how successful have you been on the Mac App Store side of it? Some developers find that the Mac App Store creates too many restrictions for them, and their app can't really blossom the way they'd like to because of those restrictions. But you sell on both. You sell on your website and the Mac App Store, right?
Yeah, we sure do. And we sell our apps with the same feature sets on both. So, you know, it was kind of a hard transition for us when Apple added sandboxing to the Mac, and they dictated that anyone who wanted to be in the App Store had to implement sandboxing, or they wouldn't accept any more updates. So some people just stopped updating their software in the store at that point, and like, well, sandboxing's too hard.
Were your apps designed so that you could gracefully move through that, their structure?
There were some hard points, and we had to drop support for some of the older operating systems when that happened, right? Sandboxing was introduced in Lion 10.7, and when we finally shipped, we shipped for 10.8 because we required some of the fixes that they had made to sandboxing when we tried to sandbox our apps and found that it just couldn't work with what they had given us in 10.7. And that was actually sort of a hard change for us as well, because that was the first time that we had dropped support for an operating system that quickly. Mm-hmm. Right?
Well, speaking of OS X, what are your thoughts on the evolution of OS X? Do you like the way it's going?
Yeah, I think, well, the biggest thing that I like is how the market continues to grow on OS X, right? And that it's, you know, it sells an unimaginable number of seats from an old Next programmer's point of view.
is most of your money coming from the Mac apps? I don't want to pry into any corporate secrets here, but I'm just curious.
I would say that it's certainly still the bulk of our revenue. Mm-hmm. iOS is a big chunk of our revenue now, but it's but our Mac products in general cost more than our, you know, are priced at a higher price point, and they do more than our iOS apps, and so we make more revenue from them, even if they have the same number of customers.
Are you equally pleased with the evolution of iOS?
I've been very pleased with the last few years of evolution of iOS. You know, in the last few years, a lot of my wish list has been implemented. You know, things like being able to search our apps with Spotlight, which we hadn't been able to do for years, and I had always, you know, wished for. The sharing extensions, so you can now send content from one app to another app, which is a big deal for our apps, and, you know, document provider extensions and so on and so forth. You know, most of my wish list at this point for how Apple could make things better for us would be improvements to their built-in apps. You know, like if you could share from Mail, you know, they have sharing support, but they don't support it in Mail at this moment. And people, you know, our customers would love to be able to share from Mail to OmniFocus. I want to send this message to OmniFocus to keep track of it.
It's kind of a tough situation when your customers clamor for something and they want something and it's so cool, but then you can't do it because of what Apple restricts you from doing.
Yeah. But, you know, it gives us something to look forward to in the future, right? And, of course, we would love to see Siri integration, too. Siri is a pretty important part of the platform. It's gotten even more important with some of their more recent platforms, right, with the Watch and TV. Mm-hmm. And we would love to be able to interact with Siri in a more rich way than just through Spotlight.
Tell me about that. If you're able to, I'd like to hear more about your thoughts about how to invoke Siri.
Like, you could imagine you might want to say, "Hey Siri, what projects do I have due in OmniFocus this week?"
Oh.
Or, "I would like to add this to this project in OmniFocus," right? You don't get specific about what you're doing.
And that's something you could pull off with the Siri interface?
If Siri gave us, you know, had an API that would let us integrate with it better. Yeah, absolutely.
That would be nice. Well, that's sort of like what people are dreaming about, as opposed to, you know, Siri, or Siri, when is this next TV show on or something. I mean, Siri's got a long way to go, because it, correct me if I'm wrong, but it kind of feels like a query response system as opposed to being a real AI tool that, you know, uses some really strong AI principles.
Right.
So It's got some ways to go, and maybe making it more available to developers to flesh out its abilities would start it on that road. I don't know. Just thoughts.
Yeah, just thoughts from me, too. Remains to be seen what's left. And of course, another big thing that Apple just added with the iPad Pro was the Apple Pencil and that support. And I have been using that a lot. I've been bringing the iPad Pro with an Apple Pencil with me to meetings and using that to write all my notes. You know, can't wait to be able to do that sort of thing with handwriting recognition in say, Omni Outliner.
Let me ask you a jackpot question. Since the Apple Pencil was so cool, do you have any birdies on your shoulder that you maybe think that the Apple Pencil will be supported on the iPad Air 3?
I don't have any information about that. I would love to see it come to the Air 3, and in fact, I would love to have it on the Mini. The Mini is the exact same size as the notepad, you know, the stenographer's notebook that I usually bring to my meetings. And so from that point of view, I think that would be a great thing. But I have no inside information.
Okay. Well, I think it would certainly expand your market, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the ability to use the Apple Pencil on more platforms with the kinds of apps you have.
Right.
Go ahead.
We did add some Apple Pencil support to OmniGraffle, for example, so that when you draw a shape, it will go ahead and recognize that shape and turn it into a real square instead of your chicken scratch of a square.
So we've talked a little bit about the future of OS X, a little bit about where iOS is going. Do you feel like iOS is focusing maybe too much on too many APIs and not enough on the user interface? How do you feel about that?
I think they certainly have a lot of opportunity to update the user interface. That Springboard, the application launching interface, feels kind of strange on an iPad Pro.
Yeah, the meme is that it's a giant iPhone, and that's not what you want.
but mostly, I don't worry about that too much as an application developer. You know, from my point of view, the iPad is designed to be this. You know, what was it that Steve said at some point, that it's this piece of glass that, you know, reflects whatever app you're running that you put on there. So I just worry about what can we do with our apps in general, and how can we make that piece of glass help people be more productive?
Yep. Well, we're starting to run out of time a little bit. I wanted to finish up with just one more question. Are there any new directions that you want to talk about that you're pondering, or directions you'd like to see Apple take? I want to just have you kind of just wildly speculate on what you think the future might hold.
Sure. Well, beyond the Siri integration from before,
sure.
I want to see more of the power of the desktop brought to iOS. You know, the iPad Pro is,
yay,
I think, you know, really showing.
I'll be first in line for that.
A lot of potential, and I feel like I don't necessarily think that this is all Apple's job to do. I think there's a lot that application developers like us can do on the platform that we are not yet doing, but that is now possible. And so, so that is how we're going to be spending our year. I mean, not all of our year. We're obviously going to work on our Mac apps as well, and we have some big updates planned there. But I can't wait to bring more of this power from the desktop to iOS.
All right. Well, I think we've covered everything, and we're just about out of time anyway. So, Ken, I want to thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, thank
you. Tell the listeners how they can contact you.
Sure. Well, our website is omnigroup.com, and my email is posted on that website. But the best way usually for people to reach me is actually through Twitter, where my handle is my first initial, K, and my last name, Case. So, KCase.
All right. Okay. Well, very cool. This has been a fascinating sort of tour of history and back to Steve Jobs and next and up to the date and into the future a little bit. So this has been really great. Thanks again for chatting with me.
Well, thank you again for inviting me.
And listeners, I hope you enjoyed the show. And thank you for coming by. We're always happy to hear you here. We'll see you next time on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.